So thanks a lot for the invitation. And thanks so much for coming out on such a beautiful day. It's really astonishing. Better? Yeah? Good? Thank you so much for coming out on such a beautiful day. It's really a sacrifice. So we'll just get on it here. So, incommensurable governance. As we swirl about in the vertiginous technosphere, the translation of our world into a data material complex brings it the promise and the threat of the total measurability of life itself. While creating machines and systems that reciprocate in creating us, a sort of general description that could stand in for the human as a techno-animal in itself, it ought to be noted. There's nonetheless a different degree of complexity in our era, as our technological capacities and scope of deployment have been dramatically altered through computational processes. So while the debates rage, the leaks mount, and our world becomes parametricized into and by probability patterns, we could maybe even call something like a regime of risk management, our modes of governance remain largely constrained by anachronistic logics that are incommensurable with this reality. So it's not our intention to dramatize our nervous system, nor fetishize in either positive or doomsday forms our technological complexity, but to insist on a structural perspective as a necessary exercise of abstraction in order to begin the arduous labor of speculation as to how modes of politicization may be actionable for emancipatory organizational procedures that can measure up to these realities. So urgent and threatening problems of our time demand a planetary scale of thought if we are to attempt to measure up. Climate change, global financialization, and communications infrastructures turned reality machines are an interconnected set of notable issues that distinctly overflow the conventions of what Benjamin Bratton has called political geographic norms. No singular nation state can fix climate change, as if the often arbitrary nature of their geopolitical borders served as any sort of laboratory enclosure. Nor does the actual GDP from states compare anywhere near to the type of value creation at work in the global derivatives market. With a $622.7 trillion difference in favor of the latter as of 2012. Steering our reality otherwise requires a move away from our familiar 2D maps of what Bratton calls horizontal global space towards a post-Westphalian simulation that charts out new geopolitical forms in their complex overlapping and interlaced strata. So in medieval cartography, here be dragons was the expression and symbolic device of mythological creatures depicted on maps to denote unknown parts of the globe. Today, the same expression is used in programming commentary to denote a section of code that works but is unintelligible. These dragons have become a device to mark the unknown, and yet the cartographic challenge before us has less to do with simply knowing the unknown, which is a forever unreachable horizon, but more to do with redefining the very playing field upon which a horizon can make appearance at all. It's time to start charting those dragons and not only defy GPS localization, but comprehensibility as well.
So this unmapped territory, you hear me okay? Is where we already are. It's our playing field, our ground, and it's constantly shifting. We are already adrift in the swells of this unreached dragon-infested stack, moving through multiple layers and a myriad of hardened softwares where the horizontal 2D return is no longer feasible, and given several affordances of our condition, perhaps no longer desirable either. We would not advocate resignation to a techno-sublime where we find ourselves left without traction from which to pivot otherwise, but an acceptance of the condition we are in as a means to an end, to an end that we do not yet know. Our questions are simple, with the caveat of ever only possibly provoking risky responses. What shape ought a 21st century emancipatory politics take in this post-Westphalian reality? And how could we reconceptualize modes of planetary scale governance and jurisdiction that assert equally a socio-political imperative within this reality?
From medieval dragons to the ancient Greeks, some ideas are so productively generic, they traverse time and space, persisting in our imaginaries in perpetual revision and redefinition. The good life, or eudaimonia, and what that might mean politically, is a question looming over every human organizational project. Projects that are always generally artificial, since they are wholly plastic enterprise subject to adaptability and change. There's no steadfast or determinate way to organize culture, behavior, coexistence, and civilization, which is precisely why such ancient questions never lose their relevance, and why, in their continual reformulation, instantiate the innovations of horizons for collective futural inclination. With our current future consumed by dystopic catastrophe and debt enslavement under a neoliberal future, the good life seems to have only legs for an exclusive group these days. The good life cannot be for one but must extend to the many, which is why such a question is perverted under a liberal ethos of individualism and capitalism, as Yevgeny was just talking about. To pose this question today, in light of our technological condition, of which I think it's crucial to note only 40% of humans have ever been online, so it's not as ubiquitous as we often seem to discuss it in these types of contexts. The good life is above all a question of justice and speculation.
Justice and law are always in a state of dynamic tension with one another. In light of information brought on by WikiLeaks and the Panama Papers, we can clearly see how our incommensurable structure of semi-porous membranes between states continues to serve the few. The borders of Westphalian states operate less as borders than they do as osmotic membranes, where some may pass through and others may not. Besides the obvious migration issues this entails, of who may be permitted to enter a territory or not, in finance, those same semi-porous membranes determine at which point potentially public-oriented funds can legally exit a territory into another semi-porous territory and become immune to taxation. What we can observe under a Westphalian infrastructure embedded in a post-Westphalian reality is a substantial mismatch between justice and law and the development of how our world actually works, guided by the pace and impatience of tech and financial products for both good and ill. Concretely speaking, the U.S. announced on Thursday that there will be attempts to close loopholes and enable the legal stashing of funds offshore for the purpose of tax avoidance. We can all assume, however, is while this is taking place within a legal framework, even more elaborate means of creating different loopholes to supersede the closing of previous ones has probably already been in the works. So the symmetry between the pace of development and the juridical structures to assess said development seems like a losing game, demanding that larger propositions be put on the table to think a collective good, such as trying to develop possibilities for a global system of taxation and provision of both the services those taxes afford. Although the scale of this thinking seems utopian and utterly out of reach, it is worthwhile noting that some historical precedents, where something like nationalized health care was also seemed like a pie-in-the-sky idea, a so-called impossibility coming out of Europe and World War II. In their recent book, Inventing the Future, Nick Cernicek and Alex Williams make the point that the move from capitalism to post-capitalism can be envisioned, contextually speaking, as the move from feudalism to capitalism. And while, of course, we know this historical shift happened, such a similar shift is what is now called for, but won't happen without cartographic intervention.
Thinking this question of an emancipatory post-Westphalian politics is tied to our capacity to alienate ourselves from current cartographies, both geographic and mental, that bind our epistemic and political modes of normative ordering, along with our corresponding behaviors. So it's in this call for alienation where we turn the negativity of the term from its cliched state as something now so-called total in late capitalism and something to be overcome in its Marxian humanist lineage, towards a generatively inhuman future. It is worth noting the semantic inaccuracies and consequences bound to the dream of an unalienated society, and why we ought to be laboring towards alienation rather than seeking to avoid it. There are qualities of alienation that seem to have been ignored that are worth highlighting. So first, as Walter Kaufman has pointed out, alienation above all describes a relation. Something is alienated from something or someone else. So any use of the term indicating a total state is simply incorrect. The term must always include at least two points of reference and requires contextualization, always moving in two directions. And second, to dream, and perhaps the most important, to dream of an unalienated society would be to celebrate familiarity as an endgame, obstructing our capacity to construct, learn, and enact new knowledge, thereby calcifying plastic norms as falsely absolute points of social reference. On a social level, we can extrapolate this even further, that a movement of alienation from the self is required to articulate the useful abstraction of a we, where particularities of identity, community, and discreteness are able to alienate themselves from strict self-reference, opening up vectors for continuums within difference.
The negative sentiment attached to the term alienation is not merely something to affirm without nuance as a 180-degree pivot against the humanist use of the word, but it is to emphasize how the condition can be useful. Perhaps the bombastic quality of the xenofeminist manifesto to declare itself a politics for alienation states the case too strongly. And to be clear, alienation is not something we need to strive for. It's not a goal in and of itself. It's a condition. It is a point of departure from which one works. And as a condition, it's not necessarily a comfortable one. It is work, work to make sense of something that is foreign, something that is unknown, but it also enables novelty and disruption of hegemonic trajectories. Alienation need not be valorized, heroicized, or romanticized. It is fundamentally a condition for the affordance of change, unbound to an individual sentiment. Just as Copernicus's discovery helped alienate human self-understanding as being the center of the universe, so too does our era require equally substantial cognitive leap as the post-human begins to peek at us over the horizon, pointing to the possibilities of what we both already are and what we might become. Alienation from the self is a useful tool to be able to think on the scale of the human as a species rather than groups of humans forming communities based on shared particularities. This would become more necessary as our planetary scale problems become more pressing. To quote Ray Brassier, on a planet of 7 billion people, the mediation of interpersonal by the impersonal is not just unavoidable, but indispensable. Tethering collectivity to community obstructs the need for a maximally expansive human solidarity. This inclusiveness of the we requires some measure of depersonalization. Impersonality, impartiality, and objectivity are not necessarily pathologies of social alienation. They can and have been positive resources, expanding the horizons of socialization beyond parochial communitarian limits. End quote. So while community,
the leaps of imagination and socio-cognitive innovation that are required to transit between heterogeneous groups and individuals, to work on gluing across difference without liberal triviality nor homogenization is, we assert, a core task for 21st century post-Westphalian politics and its subsequent cartography. The philosopher Reza Negrestani has used the term inhuman in a positive register to signify the need for alienation as a constant redefinition of humanness in light of changing contexts and our life world circumstances. So he positions this inhumanness as an infinite labor, an interminable demand. In order to recapture this plasticity to be and to co-organize otherwise in a post-Westphalian condition, in order to reshape the coordinates of what is given as a landscape of possibility for emancipatory politics within a technosphere, we need to collectively learn to unroot or alienate ourselves from the given territorial and cognitive constraints, learning to embrace the force of estrangement from what we know in order to experiment and ramify pathways for other structures of prognostic cohabitation. So if, as Brassier notes, our practical incapacities reflect our theoretical incapacities, it seems urgent to sharpen our conceptual tools, molding an affordance for an alien horizon and alien coordination system. So extending our post-Westphalian condition beyond geopolitical frameworks, we equally require a similar strategy at the level of practical disciplinarity in order to gain traction on our reality. If the Westphalian framework sets out to define geopolitical borders between territories across the globe, the same could be said of classical disciplinarity, where each branch of knowledge can be said to have its own sort of quasi-sovereign jurisdiction over a particular knowledge territory. Today we assert these classical borders impede upon the development of knowledge, both scientific and social. Concretely speaking, we cannot situate an object like climate change within a singular field of, say, an expertly fine-tuned geoscientific exploration without also considering economic perspectives, affective impacts, techniques of simulation, theories of power, colonialization, and so on. So an object like the climate overflows a singular state or epistemic territory from which it can be adequately analyzed, leading the philosopher of science, Anne-Françoise Schmidt, to qualify such contemporary things as integrative objects. To be clear, this is not a call to eliminate disciplinarity and specialization as such. Louis Althusser already warned us of the possible trivialities opened up by a liberalized celebration of interdisciplinarity in and of itself. The question, rather, is how to develop methods of synthesizing the various species of knowledge afforded by discrete disciplines into an integrative picture of the object in question. As Schmidt has noted, the classical epistemic categories may be quite fine and well for mechanical systems, but fail in relation to dynamical systems, where energy considered as potential, that is, virtual energy, evades analysis under such strict confines. So in her words, quote, "Integrative objects are no longer explicable by the convergence and the overlapping of disciplinary perspectives. They are not given. They are unknown. Their dimensions are fragments of disciplines, but articulated in a heterogeneity such that a milieu, a midsite, is necessary to conceive and receive them." End quote.
So if we are to extend this picture of mechanical systems, it could be extended into the realm of causation, wherein we would be bound to something like linear causality. This happens, causes that to happen, then a third thing. But this relies on static points and fixed definitions in a stable plane. Relies on levels of epistemic predictability or confidence about what we know and how we know it, therefore limiting its scope of applicability. This seems far less useful given much of the reality that we are faced with does not adhere to deterministic functioning, and the proliferation of information is not proliferation of knowledge. If anything, it further unmoors us. We are not on a fixed plane. It seems more an undulating donut, and the things we are trying to plot, the things we know and how we know them, are unfixed. And it's part datification that makes this more evident. To quote the genius epistemologist Donald Rumsfeld, there are known unknowns as well as unknown unknowns. The proliferation of data somehow paints an illusion that everything is available to know. But of course, not only is this not true, since not everything is available, but also finding a way to isolate what you need to know from the rest of the noise adds a layer of known unknown. One needs to know what questions to ask, and in the right way. One requires a theory of patterning to gain traction within this endless sea. So given this lack of fixity, both in terms of what we are, or what things are, where they are in relation to other things, and how to find things that are relevant, and even the order that things happen in, because even temporal linearity now seems less reliable as financial products and the force of finance has turned, and in turn the impact it has on what our reality is, it does seem important that new, perhaps porous epistemological categories, or our known and unknown knowns, need to come into being because understanding how we know, what we know, seems a much more precarious game than it once might have been.
So in a demand to militate for these integrative objects, Schmidt maps out a program of what she calls generic epistemology, wherein one can begin to articulate divergent fields of knowledge at once at a great distance from one another. So this is a counter move to the postmodern tendency to depict the sciences almost exclusively in their social dimension. Schmidt contends that, quote, "Epistemology remains essential in order to understand current sciences, but that it can no longer depend on an implicitly disciplinary conception of the sciences, end quote. Generic epistemology is charged with constructing the milieu or site that can host said integrative objects. So the site or situatedness of an object query is never given in advance. It operates under the assumption of a non-given ground of investigation. So this forces disciplines into a mode of coexistence as they become treated as parameters and not as pure content. Methodologically speaking, of course, much work needs to be done to render such a program a functional one, of constructing the cognitive transients between divergent fields of knowledge without reduction. It is a clear necessity on our collective plate if we are to begin to measure up to the types of complex, non-localizable objects that constitute our lives and assert the need for collective politicization, both epistemically and socially. The point here is to insist on the fact that no one field of knowledge is exclusively privileged enough to know such integrative objects, and the ethical thrust of such a synthetic project is bound to epistemic generosity.
So yes, so no one field can measure up to these demands, but it may indeed be useful to look to art here and ask how this field may participate in such a project. Not just because we are speaking here as part of a finissage for an exhibition program, but also because both of us happen to be artists within the Laboria Cubanics Working Group and are negotiating such questions in our own practices. The preceding outline brings in what challenges our own disciplinary normative frameworks in the field of art. Axiomatic challenges that also surpass the work of a single artist or exhibition. How art needs to alter its own self-understanding in relation to this ever-shifting terrain is equally a labor for navigation, where a generic or integrative approach could prove fruitful. Art is indeed very skilled, methodologically speaking, at pulling together several disciplines. It has a predilection for transdisciplinarity, so this facility with its epistemic promiscuity can be a fertile place to work. So to be clear, the term art here is not used to describe a delineated thing or object in a rarefied space, or not at least exclusively that, but used to describe a general condition, including its economy, modes of dissemination, representation, and its contents, and asking what sort of functional matrix ought to emerge out of these interactions. What sort of demands do we want to insist for on the operation of art so as to overcome the claims of the current state of art that are no longer fueled in reality, namely the gap between what we say art does and how it maps itself onto reality. So for some of this, I'm looking in part to Suhail Malik, who did a series of talks in 2014 and a book that should be coming out soon around an exit from contemporary art. But also, we're not looking to do an art where there's an art into life sort of project, because that actually, in many ways, has succeeded. The system of art already participates in the reality and in our everyday reality in a myriad of ways, albeit perhaps ones that would be hard to avow from the position of the left. For example, as a gentrifying force within cities, or art as a speculative investment or money laundering tool. These are, of course, not exclusively the culpability of art, nor are they the only roles, but they are notable for their success. So as the question that needs to be posed is, how can we develop art practices and an art field that has consequences beyond self-reference and beyond pure monetary or cultural capitalization, given where we are now?
There are indeed many affordances within our existing framework that could be mobilized without requiring a total negation of the field, transdisciplinarity being an important one, I think. There is, however, some important axiomatic updating that needs to take place, seeing as we can historically locate the main thrust of contemporary art's existing condition in a rather romantic model of artistic and aesthetic legitimization, wherein the free play of man's individual senses provide an emancipatory vector in opposition to top-down social conditions of control. So why does this model in general persist as a disciplinary good when we have shifted to a sprawling, complex network of control with governance from within under neoliberalism? So contemporary art remains entrenched in its idealist claims to social betterment and efficacy, bound to the imaginary good of an anachronistic historical model. It risks only to be functionally trivial, that is, utterly divorced, axiomatically speaking, from its historical actuality. So the push, rather, ought to be towards a non-trivial art, one that could substantially and systemically participate in the construction and ramification of post-capitalist horizons, if we are to construct a new condition for art's legitimization and subsequent deployment.
So what art is and how it operates needs to change, and it is changing. Many things in this exhibition exemplify it, where we can already see developments of an integrative infrastructure put to play. And I say integrative infrastructure rather than object here, because I don't want to get it confused with a sort of an idea of object-oriented ontology. In a way, I'm wanting to very much get away from the idea of glorifying an object as such. I would advocate an art that is moving away from being an object to a systemic art, and dare I say it, a platform for integrative thinking. Art is a vehicle through which to deploy upon this generic epistemology, where fields can cross-pollinate in a way that they might not be able to do on their own without a mediating discipline that would be art. We are in the process of trying to understand what this change in art is, what it ought to be, and what it means for both those who make and those who have an investment in the idea that art can be something beyond pure affect, beyond the voice of an individual. It's not time to mourn the fact that we as artists are no longer special, but to learn to alienate our self-understanding, to reorient both our thought and our making towards the consequential.
So our world transformed into this data material complex, which, we ought to highlight once again, is not all-inclusive, with the majority of roughly 4 billion fellow human beings having never been online. So it's important to inject a dose of detotalization. You want to get that? Detotalization into this discourse. Even if it could be said those participating in this new paradigm, willingly or not, are part of the minority unleashing more transformative force in the globe, for the good and for the bad, than those with no access to this infrastructure. So in our context here, this transformation is a symptom of what Peter Wolfendale has noted as a tendency towards dehumanization. So the term here is not used in a pejorative way, but to index the human's ongoing decentering and processes of destabilization, destabilizing the normative equilibriums that have sustained the human species for centuries, if not longer. Either via the Anthropocene, where our life world is being pushed to a point of no longer being able to host human life, the economy with increased automation of labor and machine learning, and finally, the human animal itself, where biochemical interventions alter our core psychological, biological, and reproductive structures. The problematics our diagnoses reveal point not to questions of how to return to an imaginary equilibrium that never was, but how to seize upon this post-human condition and integrate modes of social and epistemic politics commensurate to this reality that structurally aim to serve the many, arresting our current and increasingly violent tendency that serves only the very few. Thanks.